lowered her head, hiding her face in the shadow of her hood. Yet she saw it when the Jew lifted the flame before Peter to make him visible. "Master Peter Abelard," the Jew said. "Your Holiness," Peter half bowed, "forgive this violation of the peace of your household. We are in great need of your counsel." For a long time, the Jew was silent and impassive. Finally, without a word, he stepped aside. Peter led Eloise into the house, and the Jew pulled the door closed behind them. In two corners of the first room, barely more than a vestibule, were blanketed sleepers. They did not stir. Servants. If the Jew had family, they would be on the warmer floor above in the eaves. Peter seemed to know where to go, and he crossed into a second larger room where a pair of benches flanked a hearth in which embers smoldered. In from a third room washed a cone of yellow light, and Peter went directly there. Eloise followed. A slightly elevated ceiling accommodated an arrangement of shelving that covered two walls. The shelves were made of hewn lumber. One set held a hodgepodge of vessels, earthenware jars and pots, some large. The other, she saw with astonishment, held pyramids of scrolls and stacked codices, books, a rich man's library. Running the length of the third wall was a single low shelf of double planks, on which rugs and animal skins were haphazardly spread, a sleeping pallet. The Jews? In the room's center was a rectangular table on which the candlestick stood. Fresh-cut rushes, intermingled, judging from the scents, with lavender, lemon balm, and thyme, were spread on the hard-caked mud of the floor. The table also held a stripped feather quill, a knife, a horn of carbon ink, and a fan of vellum pages, on which could be seen the small, angled marks that Eloise recognized as Hebrew letters. The Jew placed the oil lamp on a shelf, then began efficiently to clear the table, shifting its material to the bench. From the easy agility with which he moved, Eloise saw that the man was not as aged as the white of his flamboyant hair and beard had suggested. The skin around his eyes and mouth was smooth. Once the table was clear, the Jew drew himself up to his full height, touched his cap and bowed to Eloise, his first acknowledgment of her. In return, she nodded. The Jew then stooped to pull a stool out from under the table, and Peter, opposite, knew to do likewise. The Jew sat. Peter arranged the stool for Eloise. She collected the drapery of her gowns and cloak and sat. Peter stood behind her. "We come to you with secrets," Peter said. The Jew's almost imperceptible nod seemed the appropriate reply. His hands were folded on the table. Peter continued, "We have reason to believe that we have conceived a child." The Jew showed nothing. His gaze went to Eloise, who, to her surprise, sensed in him nothing but kindness. She said, "It is true, I am certain." The Jew said, "No one can match you in this knowledge." Peter said, "But is there a way to be more certain? Secrets of the Talmud, the Moorish texts?" Though the Jew spoke in answer to Peter, he did not take his eyes from Eloise. "The way to stand beyond question is to listen to the one who knows. Neither the Talmud nor the canon of Ibn Sina compare to that. Is it you, my lady, who seeks my counsel?" "I yield to Master Peter Abelard," she answered. "He has set us in flight from superstition. What would you do to confirm my condition? With your science, I mean." "There are measures," the Jew said. "What measures?" The Jew stood and turned to the shelves behind him. He opened a metal box and, with pinched fingers, carefully placed something in his cupped hand. Then he turned back to sit again. He spilled onto the table a small quantity of seeds and a single shoot of wheat. "In the privacy of your place," he said, "if you chose to adopt this method, you would keep these moist with your urina, the fluid discharge from your bladder. These are barley seeds. This is a spike of emmer wheat. If, after 2 days, either the seeds failed to sprout or the emmer failed to germinate, then you would know that you are not with child. It is possible. On the other hand, the quickening of either the barley or the wheat would mean that you are indeed with child with a high degree of certainty. And as for the," Peter hesitated, "state of being male or female," the Jew answered solemnly, "some say that if the barley sprouts before the emmer, the child will be male, vice versa, female. This part of the measure is also reliably accurate," all at once the Jew smiled, "about half the time." Eloise did not match his smile. She said soberly, "For the knowledge of my son's gender, I was instructed to let a drop of discharge from my breast fall into the water." "Yes," the Jew said, "to see if it floats. Also reliably accurate. About half the time." Again a smile. "But my knowledge does not depend on experiments," Eloise said. The Jew shrugged. Peter asked, "And what of my lady's well-being?" The Jew opened his hands. "God in his wisdom has prepared the woman magnificently for this miracle." Addressing Eloise, he said, "You are a healthy girl, I see that. Good color in your face, the proper pink in the cuticles of your fingernails, robust posture, hips. You have come into womanhood with grace. Is this your question or only his?"
"It is mine."
"Then may I ask questions of my own?"
"Yes."
"Is there pain in your abdomen?"
"No."
"Difficulty in emptying the bowels?"
"Some, yes."
The Jew nodded. "The body adjusts, as your digestion now must feed 2 stomachs. If that difficulty persists, have your kitchen prepare squash boiled in ale. Take it in with mustard. What of your blood flow?"
"It was regular until now. I should have had the monthly flowers 3 weeks ago."
The Jew nodded. "The body economizes with blood now, supplying the coming child. In these weeks, are mornings difficult for you?"
"Yes. Biliousness."
"Also, as it should be. The body purifies itself, expelling malignant humors. The Lord is making you ready. You will be formidable at this. You were made for it." Eloise was stunned to find tears welling in her eyes. "My mother died while giving birth." She blurted this, having never meant to refer to her poor mother's fate, the trauma of her own witnessing of it. "I am sorry," the Jew said, "but that unhappy outcome, it was not when you yourself were born?"
"No."
He moved his head up and down slowly, indicating a conclusion. "You will die, my lady, but not of this child, not of this birth. You will live a long, good life." The Jew said this as if his knowledge were certain, and Eloise thought of Simeon, the just man of Jerusalem, who consoled the mother of Jesus. The Jew continued, "Still, it is true that the birth will be difficult, and you are right to be afraid. It is fear
that I sense in you, is it not? The tears spilled out of her eyes. Eloise nodded, yes. The Jew reached across the table and took her hand. But you were made to bear the difficulty. The fearsomeness will be nothing when your child is placed in your arms. Peter put in, St. Paul says as much. But neither the Jew nor Eloise acknowledged him. I repeat, the Jew began. Now he covered the hand of Eloise with his second hand. You will be formidable. And between now and then, Peter asked. The Jew waited for Eloise to ratify the question with her nod. He said, what you eat will affect your unborn child. Dry food. Avoid fluids that are cold. Avoid acidic fruits like pomegranate, or mix them with wine. Dry and crush the flowers of fruit-bearing plants and brew them into tea. As the time progresses, confinement is appropriate, as if you yourself were returning to the womb. When the child is coming, you will do well to have your flanks rubbed with rose oil, but only for comfort. Your body will supply what you and your child need. Trust that. Will the child be deformed? The Jew shrugged. He said, no more than all the sons and daughters of Adam are. Some deformities are of the body, some are of the spirit, but no one is spared, which is why we must be kind to one another. Caring for yourself is the way to care for your child. Leave the rest to the Holy One, who watches you, nay, who abides in you right now. It is the Holy One you are carrying. Blessed are you, my lady. The Jew stood. When his glance went to Peter, Peter said, you know that for us there will be particular troubles. The Jew nodded. Your privilege, Master, is to protect her from the troubles. Protecting your woman is your privilege and solemn obligation. Eloise stood, but she leaned forward. The barley seed, she said. The wheat. Yes. The Jew turned and took a small square of purple velvet and a cord from a shelf, material prepared for such a purpose. He placed the square in the palm of one hand, then, with the other, swept the seeds and shoot onto the velvet, folded its corners up, and deftly tied them with the cord, a pouch. He handed it to Eloise. She said, I will do as you said, but for Master Peter's sake. I know I have a son. The Jew nodded. I believe you do. In the moments it required to pass out of the Vicus Judaeorum and through the jumbled market stalls, neither Peter nor Eloise spoke. Finally, as they approached the wall of the cathedral close, they halted in sync and faced each other. Eloise went up on her toes to lose herself inside the cave of his hood, to kiss him. Peter encircled her with his arms and returned her kiss. The intensity with which they clung together was, even for them, unprecedented. Eloise thought she would break with feeling. Pulling back at last, she said, thank you for bringing me to your prince. My darling, he replied, we have only just begun. I will protect you. I will marry you. She laughed. Marry me? What is that? We cannot get married. Of course we can. We must. Why? Abelard was thrown. The question of honor, he said. I care nothing for honor, she answered. He shook his head, scrambling to keep up with her. Consider your uncle, then. Honor is all he cares for. Fulbert will see a grievous breach of honor, his honor, the honor of your mother's family, the honor of the queen consort, therefore the honor of the king, to say nothing of yours.
Mine, she said, my honor is to be your paramour. That is enough for me. Were we to marry, your rivals would drive you from Paris. Your license to teach would be revoked, your clerical status nullified.
She was speaking as one whose thoughts on the matter were well laid out. She had already aligned this furrow on the field they were crossing.
If you were reduced to the lay state, she continued, your career as a philosopher would be finished. You, the most esteemed philosopher in Christendom, ruined. Because of me, I will not hear of it.
But without marriage? Peter, what is marriage to us? Are we not already bound for life? What need have we for the matrimonial cult? We are sworn already, are we not?
Yes.
Then we are married already.
Yes, but no one need know, dear Peter. Our secret marriage, by being secret, secures your place at the pinnacle of scholars.
Now it was Abelard who laughed, but he stifled himself to whisper,
you are carrying a child, woman. That secret will be kept for 1 month more, two at most.
Then, as Prince Isaac said, you will need protection.
Only sacramental matrimony protects you, protects our child.
What is philosophy to that?
What is Paris? I care nothing for either. I care only for you.
She cupped her hand at his mouth to silence him.
She, too, whispered, I speak not of the mere vanity of the school, but of what you are embarked upon there. You are teaching a new mode of thought. Thought itself, how to follow the chain of reason, to go wherever it leads.
He pulled his mouth free.
Not if it goes against God.
But there's the point, Peter, the point of your every lecture. Reason cannot go against God, since reason is God's gift.
To Eloise, Peter was God's gift, pure and simple. God had put him in Paris. God had licensed his teaching. God needed him to carry on his new philosophy. With God at its center, why else should he not have invented a word for it, theology?
Abelard cast his eyes about. The faint glow of the coming dawn was in the air.
This is no time for talk about God, he said.
I am talking about you, she said.
Your teaching, its importance, your God.
Through her cloak, he gently squeezed her upper arm. It is only Christ's God whom we worship.
Yes, I have heard you speak boldly of Christ's God, the one who sent his Son not to die but to live.
That was indeed the watchword of his teaching, as she knew better than anyone. Peter Abelard held that salvation need not be won by appeasing an angry God, as the fathers had it, because salvation already abounds in a loving God's economy.
Life, therefore, she insisted now, not death, mercy, not judgment, there is your teaching.
You learn well, woman, he said quietly, but she was impassioned now.
You are rewriting all that has been written. Sacraments do not save us, they merely celebrate that we are saved. Your ideas are great, and they are dangerous.
It was true. Dangerous to the established order of hierarchy. The church-empowered gatekeepers of grace posed a threat to Peter Abelard of which Eloise was more aware, perhaps, than he. If God's salvation was universally on offer, what need was there of priests, of bishops, of popes? Abelard's enemies, muttering in the shadows of the cloister, were poised to encircle him, to do more now than shout about flouted doctrine. Her ferocious rejection of marriage was rooted in an absolute determination not to be the instrument of Peter Abelard's defeat by such dolts.
But dear, sweet Eloise, again he cast his eyes about,
were they being overheard? were the morning servants soon to appear? He began to tug at her, to draw this contest to its close. But by now her only impulse was to warn him. "No, Peter," she whispered intensely, "listen to me. I know of the upcoming great chapter meeting of the so-called reformers at Chartres, where your teaching will be challenged on behalf of William of Champeaux."
"How do you know of that?" he asked.
"The schoolboys know of it. Why shouldn't I?" Peter famously kept his distance from the gossip that fueled the chatter of his students. They sat at his feet, but they also longed to see him in high-stakes verbal combat, never imagining that he could be vanquished. Yet Eloise understood that even verbal combat could be deadly. His critics were arming themselves against him. She said more quietly, "All the talk is of this upstart white monk, your self-anointed inquisitor." "A nobody," Peter answered, "but not self-anointed. He is commissioned not by Champeaux, but by the toothless old lion, Anselm." "Anselm is your nemesis, Peter, the great defender of the monster god you repudiate. Old lions are dangerous when teamed with young jackals." "The white monk, why is he called that?" Peter answered, "He is too pure to wear the black robes of Saint Benedict like the rest of us. The white habit is his claim to righteousness. His name is Bernard." She said, "If purity is his shibboleth, he threatens you doubly now, when he mixes illicit love into the cauldron of charges to be brought. Bernard will boil you. You will be scorned, and your reading of the gospel will be lost, a catastrophe. Do not puff up my importance, woman. Do not deny it, man. Your work is only just begun. You promised the Prince of the Jews that you would protect your woman. You protect her by protecting the truth of your work. That is all." "No, listen to me," he demanded. He released her and stepped back. He steepled his hands before his chin, a posture of supplication. He spoke urgently, but still in a whisper. "Suppose all that you say is true. Even so, your words are mere bubbles in the air. Come down to earth with me. You yourself said it. I wear the tonsure. The rule of clergy applies to me. The bishops are ruthlessly enforcing it. If I remain as I am, a canon of the cathedral, our son, if such it is, will be seized from us, filius nullius, yes, to be a slave of the church, and you will be a scorned woman." She said, "I will not openly marry you, nor will I remain in Paris. You protect me by protecting the pulse of my heart, my Peter Abelard, who is also the creator of a whole new way of thinking and learning and believing. Who am I to that? You are the absolute to me," he said firmly. "Good. Then my will is absolute. You must obey it." "But how?" He opened his hands, a gesture of helplessness before her fierceness. "I have thought this through," she said, "using the train of logic I have from you." She spoke with unrelenting earnestness. "My uncle's honor, my health, the safe delivery of our son, the secret of our love, all of this is secured by my return to the convent at Argenteuil, not as its orphaned ward, as before, nor as a senior pupil, but as a sister under the vow of postulancy."
"What?"
"No, let me. I have thought this through. I say, listen, I will enter the convent at Argenteuil. Once initially professed, I will be sent away for the year-long postulancy in the remote novitiate. Such claustration is a mandate of the rule. All sisters begin by dying to the world, and so will I. The prescribed 1 year and 1 day, gone. At my disappearance, my uncle, instead of humiliated and enraged, will be credited with my religious vocation, not to mention his relief at being freed of responsibility for me. And Lady Gisela, the cousin of my mother whom he so fears, will be edified. Mother Prioress, because of my flimsy tie to the royal household, and because she loves me, will protect my secret. All of this will unfold soon, at once, apparently under the urgent inspiration of the Holy Ghost. So no one will know the truth of what I bear. But under vows, he said, you, a false oath? This is violence, violence to the absolute will you just declared, violence to our love. You have vows, she said. I told you I will renounce them. So will I, she answered, when the child is safely delivered. I will resume my life, my formidable life, as Prince Isaac put it. I will discover that my vocation lies elsewhere than in vowed consecration. Perhaps I will become one of those useful unmarried women of the court who take care of the neglected children of the royals. Perhaps one of those children could be our own child, a ward of the household, whom I could love as my own child, as indeed I would. Eloise paused before going on with sudden gravity. The only thing formidable about me, Peter Abelard, is you. If we proceed in this way, our child will be safe, and our hidden bond can quicken once more and thrive again, as it has until now. Never, never, he said. His face had darkened with a look of disbelief. That this woman could so surprise him, so shock him. You would make a solemn vow, consciously intending to forswear it? Never! Peter Abelard took her by the shoulders, gripping her more fiercely than he knew. My violation of holy orders is a mistake, he said, an accident. I repent of it and will seek dispensation. Your violation would be deliberate, a knowing falsification in advance, before God himself, solemnly sworn, a sacrilege, woman. You care nothing for philosophy, she said. I care nothing for vows, and neither does an all-loving God. Don't you see? I am carrying your logic to its conclusion. We are beloved of God, whether we are in vows or not, and if the false swearing of an oath saves a life or protects the greater truth, then Christ himself would swear it. Peter Abelard, for a moment, could not speak. How was this unfolding before him? Who was this woman? Finally, with rare ferocity and still gripping her, he said, "This is no teaching of mine." "Dear Peter, it follows from your teaching." "Then my enemies are right." "Do not say that, Peter, I beg of you. Do not say that. You would not be risking your soul, woman. You would be damning it, for certain. I will have nothing to do with this. I will not permit it." "I am not asking your permission." "How dare you? The child is ours together. The solution to our dilemma must be won together." He roughly released her. Eloise had never seen Peter so angry. But then she realized this was not anger. This was passionate protection, his protection of her soul, that she cared not one whit for some supposed eternal doom surprised her as much as him. She simply did not believe in the demon god who would make it so. In any case, her soul's damnation in an imagined afterlife was pure abstraction, whereas the present destruction of Peter Abelard's thought the silencing of his voice, the reduction to ash of his rare wisdom, all because of her. This was Hades here and now.
Chastened, she asked,
then what is there for us? The last hour of night, with its dampness, weighed upon them. Finally, Peter said,
Lucille,
Nantes.
What?
My sister, her Breton village, a simple journey on the river Loire. We will go there. She will care for you. She has 4 children already underfoot. She is a masterpiece of motherhood. She will see you through your confinement, and she will see you safely delivered. For your sake, I will continue to meet my obligations at the cathedral school, but I will manage to be with you for days and weeks at a time. Peter did not say it or need to, but her going to Nantes would mean that she had not falsified a sacred vow or jeopardized her immortal soul. She would not have blasphemed, which on his scale was the weight that mattered most. He added, in these months our child will healthily come to term, but so will our mutual knowledge of the way forward. I say again, the child is ours together. The solution to our dilemma must be won together. We will find it. There's my marriage vow, dear wife of mine. I will take you to Nantes as soon as a keel can be readied.
But my uncle,
your uncle, the fool, is easily handled. The Loire borders Bourgogne, the realm of your mother's cousin. Use the available truth. The Loire, you've been unexpectedly summoned, which is, of course, the case. Imply that Lady Gisela has sent for you, a matter of your coming-of-age homage among the ladies-in-waiting in that distant retinue. The business of women tending to women at the court of the Duke. Imply that the queen consort will be there. All of that will silence your uncle. Again, Peter Abelard encircled her with his arms, and again she yielded to him. After a moment, she pulled back just enough to whisper,
meanwhile, I will soak the barley seeds in piss, and if they fail to sprout, I will signal you.
I pray to God for the germination, he said. They laughed and hugged, now with relief and delight. Neither knew it at that moment, although both would come roughly to the recognition later. But Brother Thrall, Fulbert's servus, was watching through the boards of the garden horse gate.
Chapter 10. Complications, he'd said, trying to explain himself, but he could tell from Rachel Vedette's quizzical expression that the word epitomized his fakery. She repeated, complications. Michael Cavanaugh stood mutely, not moving a muscle. Finally, at the mercy of rank physical sensation, he blurted, forgive me, I've a splitting headache. On Madison Avenue 2 hours before, he had thought, a stroke, this is a stroke. But that piercing pain had eased off, leaving, as a residue of his meeting with Bishop Donovan, a mundane but still screeching hurt behind his eyes. Do you mind if I sit down? He asked. Of course not, she said, clearly surprised at his acknowledgement. Even in that brisk phrase, he heard her French accent, still exotic. She said, with a gesture at the stone bench running the length of the wall, although from 1,000 years ago the place is uncomfortable, she smiled thinly, where they confessed infractions of the rule. Cavanaugh stared at her for a moment, feeling put off, yes, but also struck again by her erudition. The woman knew so much more about this world than he did, and yet this world was his. He had come here from the bishop's office like a pigeon hurtling its way home. Unlike the day before, when it had seemed only alien, the faux monastery today was an accidental refuge. He crossed to the stone bench and took a place a couple of yards away from her. He put his breviary down. "What a stupid thing," I just said. "Sometimes I amaze myself." He dared to look at her and was surprised to see that, as she returned his gaze, she seemed not cold, as before, but kind. She said, "What stupid thing?" Perhaps it was her lush accent that made her seem kind. "About conscience," he explained. He was afraid that she'd taken his "aw shucks" attempt at self-mockery literally. "My knowing everything about conscience, the truth is, I know very little." "That cannot be true, Father." Kavanaugh exhaled a little laugh. "No, you're right, but if I knew everything, I wouldn't have come back here today. I've been thrown for a loop." He stopped himself. He could not describe what had happened on the avenue. He said only, "I was downtown at the cathedral, or rather, the chancery, seeing the boss."
"The cardinal?"
"No, the vicar," he laughed. "A lowly parish priest is not important enough to have business with Cardinal Spellman. Coming back to Inwood, I don't think I actually decided to return here, I just did. Got off the subway one stop early and headed into the park. Next thing I know, here I am. If I've intruded on you again, it's not deliberate." Even as Kavanaugh said this, he realized it was untrue. Only partly conscious, perhaps, but he had come here on purpose. For this stranger. But his headache clawed at his sinuses. The pain, was that what was making him nuts? "Not intrusion, Father. I am here for the public. But I interrupted your lunch break." By raising her book slightly, she conveyed that her break was given over to reading, not eating. Kavanaugh eyed the thin, worn leather volume. She had been carrying it yesterday. He touched his breviary and repeated what she had said. "You have your book, I have mine." His question was implied. "What are you reading?" As if in answer, she drew the book flat to her chest, concealing it. "Le Moyen Âge?" he asked. "Is that the phrase?" "Très bon, mon père. Yes, des lettres. Some letters." "So you're studying?" "Not precisely," she shrugged. "I know these letters very well. My book, peut-être, is like your book, a friend." "Something to carry," Kavanaugh said, and picked up the breviary, letting its soft leather covers flap, to add offhandedly, "a priest's swagger stick."
"A what?"
"Swagger stick, what a Marine Corps colonel carries." "Ah, baton. The marshals of France carry the baton. For fending off peasants, I believe." Kavanaugh gestured with the book. "In public, one can indeed fend off with this thing, burying one's face in it, pretending to pray. I do it all the time." "I doubt that, Father. You do not pretend, nor do you fend off." "Actually," he said, "I'm rarely this forward. My headache, for example, normally I would never refer to it." She lifted her shoulders pleasantly. "Revelations of the Chapter House," she said. Kavanaugh looked around. The rough stone, the iron sconces and wall sculptures, the triptych Golgotha, which gave as much prominence to the two thieves as to the crucified Lord. As if her remark had been the abbot's call to examine conscientiae, he let his gaze settle on the floor. "What," he wondered suddenly, "am I doing here?" Kavanaugh sensed her falling into silence, too. "Magnum silentium," she had said the day before, a phrase he had not used himself in years.
When the great silence fell each night in the seminary, students were supposed to be in their rooms with the doors closed. One time, after the forbidden hour, someone had rapped softly on his door, and the bolt of alarm Kavanaugh had felt at the sound came back to him now. When he'd opened the door, there was Runner looking abashed. A major term paper was due the next morning, and he was stumped. He had his notebook. He needed help. Kavanaugh had let him into his room briefly, but had been so obviously worried by the infractions they were committing, not only breaking the silence but also the threshold rule, that Runner had hustled away, leaving Kavanaugh feeling foolish and guilty. He pushed the memory away, but the feeling stayed. He leaned forward to lower his head into his hands, not out of embarrassment that he had shown up here, or perplexity at why, although he felt both, but simply because the pressure at his temples threatened to burst. "Jesus, Runner, it's the great silence. What the hell?" With poised fingers, he pushed back against his pulsing veins, but now what he recalled were those moments on Madison Avenue a little while ago. Non credo. Not a stroke, okay, but something, something. What is happening to me? Though he was obsessed with himself just then, Kavanaugh was aware of it when the woman stood and walked away, her footfalls fading softly as she crossed the stone floor out into the arcade to the building beyond. And that was that, he thought. She had done to him a version of what he had done to Bishop Donovan, just walking out. She had sensed his trouble and wanted no part of it. But what was his trouble? "Here, Father." He looked up. She'd returned without his hearing and was standing before him with a glass of water in one hand and in the other a pair of white pills. Her book was wedged between her elbow and her side. "Aspirin," she said. Her fingers struck him again, long and spindle-like. The white of the pills emphasized the pallor of the skin that stretched tightly across her palm. The cuff of her white sleeve was tightly fastened, not buttoned, Kavanaugh saw now, but gathered at her wrist with an elastic band. He took the pills and then the water. "Thank you, miss. You're very kind. I hope it helps." "It helps already." They were quiet for a moment, not moving. Finally the woman said, "Thrown for a loop, a strange expression." "A stranger feeling," he said, surprised that she'd steered back to his admission. "Unsettled," he said, "caught off guard. What would you say in French?" "Pris au dépourvu, bouleversé, perhaps, peut-être." "Yesterday," he said slowly, "when I came here, it was because someone I knew well once, but hadn't seen in years. He came to the early morning mass. He knelt for communion, but then wouldn't receive the host. He gave me the strangest look, then left. I followed him. I saw him come into the park. So, then, later, I did too. I never found him. Then it started to rain. I ducked in here." "And we met," she said. "Yes. And now I find myself starting to explain." "You started to explain yesterday, Father. And you walked away." Standing before him, she had her arms folded now, like a woman to whom some accounting was due. She asked, "Why did you come back?" "Because of something else that happened just this morning, in my meeting with the bishop." He hesitated. He didn't want her thinking he'd returned because of her. He raised his eyebrows, indicating the chapter house, the arcade, the cloister, all of it. "I guess I needed some quiet in which to collect myself." "Yes," she said, "the cloister is good for that." With a glance back toward the arcade, she said, "At the front desk, a group is waiting. It is time for my tour.
Of course, Kavanaugh said, and he felt heat rush into his face. Again. The madness of his being here. The rudeness.
Memory Palace, she said, with a sweep of her hand around the chapter house. Your phrase. Perhaps I will use that in my little talk, may I?
Kavanaugh laughed, and then so did she, which prompted him to say,
That fellow from my past showing up like that yesterday opened memories I haven't thought of in...
His voice trailed off.
He is what threw you for a loop?
Right.
Which you mentioned to me because you will not see me again.
And the same for you, right? He said. You're being nice to me because I am a museum visitor, not a monk in the chapter house, reviewing the rule, accusing himself.
Nice? She shook her head. Aspirin is not so much.
The skin at her cheeks was tinged with pink. She, too, was blushing. With the glass in her one hand, she hugged herself, the book to her chest.
Unless he said quietly, There is another time, another place.
She took a step back.
Impossible.
She muttered the word in French, and he understood it. She turned and walked quickly away.
Kavanaugh watched her go, his foolishness confirmed. He wanted out of the place as quickly as possible, but forced himself to wait a moment. Then he too left. In the central hall, which opened into the several separate cloisters, but also into the staircase spiraling down to the entrance foyer, Rachel Vedette was greeting the ladies of the tour group, five of them. Her back was to Kavanaugh, which relieved him, and he made for the stairwell, expecting not to encounter her again. He took the stairs at a clip. By the time he reached the desk at the main entrance, he was aware that someone was coming after him, but he did not stop. He went past the prim attendant without looking at her. The cold air outside surprised him, as did the bright light. Father, she called, but he kept going. He'd been dragged across a threshold into a forbidden room and was now trying to crawl out of it again. Father! He stopped and turned. She was there behind him. Before, she had seemed collected, reserved, but no more. He recognized in her expression a version of the visceral impulsiveness that had seized him. She gestured with her book and said, This is the story of Abelard and the letters he exchanged with Eloise. Today, earlier, already, before you came, they made me think of you.
Abelard and Eloise, he said, the monk and nun?
Yes, although monk and nun hardly defines it. She was the greatest abbess of the age. He was the greatest scholar. I know their words by heart, yet I still long to understand.
She could not finish.
I hardly know them, he said. Abelard was a hedonist, right? Not in the calendar of saints, not in the canonical syllabus.
She replied, To say that Abelard was a hedonist is, you say, simpliste.
Simplistic, he supplied.
He was the enemy of Bernard of Clairvaux, but...
Bernard we studied, he said.
Saint Bernard, very canonical.
But of course, she said, Bernard was the victor. Victors define the syllabus. Those defeated are cast aside. But Abelard... She hesitated again, clumsily, and he thought it was because their exchange had become so stilted, academic almost. What is going on? But then, having centered herself, she continued. There is religious grandeur in Abelard. Hedonism had nothing to do with it. That is the ancient slander, Bernard's slander.
Kavanaugh said, I thought... Abelard
and Eloise stood convicted by their love affair.
Which was the least of it, she said.
Well, perhaps not for Eloise. She smiled slyly.
Eloise is another matter.
She pressed the book against herself, conveying its preciousness.
These letters show a great contest between two people, but also a contest of the two people against the whole rest of their age. They are humanists, the first humanists, but also mystics. The two things feed each other.
He replied, I never heard that said.
Eloise has a deep attachment to the holy.
The docent was speaking now in a rush of pent-up expression, as if a dam had burst inside her,
but also a savage indignation toward God. Abelard refuses to match her in that, but because of her, he finds it possible to stand against the whole world, for the world, for the human, and for the holy, both. How was that? What sort of faith makes that possible? I have never discussed this with a priest.
An ignorant priest, he said.
But a priest! It's why I have...
With a toss of her hands, she conveyed, why I have so foolishly come after you. She cared nothing, clearly, about the odd impression she was making. She was speaking like an unleashed person who had no choice but, yes, to speak. She said,
you live in their world of reference, no?
The vocation, the call from God, readiness to stake everything on the absolute, that is what compels me about them, but also mystifies me. I cannot let go of them, but neither can I understand. Now her words, suddenly, began to come more slowly. There is something essential that I miss, because I do not believe in God. That she had made such an admission, Kavanaugh saw, surprised her utterly. She underscored it with stern gravity, but also with palpable alarm. Kavanaugh thought back to his own moment on Madison Avenue. Non credo. What the hell was that? Then he thought of Bishop Donovan and their sentimental exchange. To daily go from men to God, to return from God to men, bringing pardon and hope. What was it the bishop had said? Not a bad vocation, that. The woman pointed down the road, a serpentine curl through the overarching, bare November trees. She said, there is a coffee shop halfway to the subway. I stop there sometimes on my way home. Coffee keeps me alive. What time? He asked. A bit after 4 o'clock. Kavanaugh could bring himself to do nothing more than nod. Rachel Vedette turned and hurried back to the museum. He watched her go, at first taking in the way her legs moved inside her long, swirling skirt. Then he looked away as a phrase popped into his aching head. Custody of the eyes. That afternoon, in his room at the rectory, Kavanaugh had changed his mind twice, before deciding, after all, to wear the Roman collar. He'd thought of going in his windbreaker because that was how he'd first met her, but he knew now that the collar, his world of reference, defined her interest. He made the uniform complete by bringing his breviary, although in leaving his room he'd thought also to bring the Simone Weil book. But no, he left behind the French Jew's exchange of letters with a priest. Though he had never been in the coffee shop, he'd been aware of it, a refurbished stone and timber Tudor cottage, the sort of little structure that a groundskeeper would have occupied in a more feudal age. Come to think of it, that's probably what it had been on the 19th-century robber baron estate that Rockefeller would have requisitioned for his monastic museum folly. Inside, the place was linoleum tiles, formica tables, glass and chrome sugar dispensers, tall fold napkin holders, and round tin ashtrays. Kavanaugh, the lone customer, took a table by the window, overlooking the road that cut through the hilly, wooded Fort Tryon Park. He lit a cigarette. He saw her coming, but did not recognize her at first, so dramatically was her look altered by what she was wearing. A flowing black cape and a tight-fitting black turban. As she drew closer, he saw how the headdress pulled her brows down over the dark pool of her eyes, a slant that gave her face a hint of the east he had not seen before. When she entered, he stood, cigarette in hand. She barely looked at him as she took a chair on the opposite side of the small table. Before they spoke, a waitress appeared from behind the large refrigerated case that displayed pies and preset bowls of pudding. The waitress was a stout woman, wearing a pencil in the bun of her hair behind the pointed white headpiece. "Hiya, Father," she said happily, and even in that brisk greeting, the harp of her brogue played itself. "What'll it be? It's on the house." She said this without a glance at Rachel Vedette. Kavanaugh exchanged rote pleasantries with the waitress, and he ordered two coffees. While they waited, Kavanaugh offered his cigarette pack. Miss Vedette took one and leaned forward for his light. They took refuge, each of them, in the business of smoking. The waitress returned with the coffees, then disappeared again. Miss Vedette said, "She serves me coffee most afternoons. She has never greeted me. I believe she has never seen me." "Don't be offended," he said. "She didn't see me either." Kavanaugh lodged his cigarette between his lips and flicked his celluloid collar. He knew full well that this eccentric French woman, too, was seeing only that. Rachel put her book on the table next to his. Kavanaugh extended his hand. "May I?" She nodded. He picked the volume up. The worn leather cover was smooth to the touch. The pages were edged with faded gold leaf. He opened the book to the title page. Historia Calamitatum, Eloise et Abelardi Epistolae. He turned the page. "It's in Latin," he said, showing surprise. "Of course. But Paris, I would have thought French. Early 12th century, Father. French did not exist quite yet. The earliest chanson de geste came just a bit later. Educated people would have written to each other in Latin." "And you know the language?" he asked. "I attended the Lycée Classique. Latin was routine." "And your English?" "My English came later. It helped with my coming to America." He offered the book back to her. "Would you read something?" he asked. "But as a priest, you know Latin." "I know church Latin, the Holy Office, the Mass, the Creed. Otherwise..." He shrugged, but again, "non credo" popped into his mind. "Thomas Aquinas?" she asked. "Of course," he said. "Not so sure about Virgil." She said, "This book is in the idiom of Aquinas, so you will know it." Still, she took the volume. She let her eyes settle on the first page and, with a placid neutrality, began to translate. "There was in Paris a young creature, ah, Philintus, formed in a prodigality of nature to show mankind a finished composition. she interrupted herself. This is Abelard to Philantus, a friend.
Dating from? He asked.
From 1130.